Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to a new episode and a new year of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini, McDermott, Will, and Schulte, and Rich Lenkov from Downey & Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. Well, since last we spoke, Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro and his wife were captured in a U.S. military strike inside of that country. Is it legal to capture a country's leader to face charges in the U.S.? Well, the U.N. Security Council has been mulling that over. Milena Stereo is a professor of law, International Law Center at Cleveland State University. She's got some thoughts on this topic. Professor, thanks so much for coming on with us.
It's a pleasure.
Professor, you said that removing a foreign leader from his country without extradition is, quote, completely illegal under international law. Explain that, please, to us.
That is correct. Since the end of World War II, the United Nations Charter in its Article 2.4 prohibits countries from staging actions which would be viewed as a violation of another country's territorial integrity or political independence. What this means in layperson's term is that the UN Charter prohibits the use of force by one country against another country. And that's that principle, which is enshrined in the UN Charter, is also by today part of what we call customary law, which is binding on all states. And so when the United States decided to send its military force into Venezuela, which is an independent sovereign country, it violated both the territorial integrity as well as the political independence of Venezuela. And those acts are clearly prohibited by the United Nations Charter as well as by customary international law.
So, Professor, the Trump administration, and we've seen this all over the press, has framed this operation as a law enforcement function rather than a military action. From an international law perspective, is that distinction meaningful, or does the use of armed force inside another sovereign nation override that label entirely?
From the international law standpoint, this distinction is not really meaningful because it's prohibited one way or the other. So let me explain that. While countries have the ability to apply their own laws extraterritorially, countries do not have the ability to conduct law enforcement operations on the territory of other sovereign independent nations. Countries cannot just send their own military or police force to conduct any type of a law enforcement operation on the territory of another country. Imagine if, for example, Mexico wanted to arrest a U.S. citizen in the United States, if that U.S. citizen were wanted by Mexican authorities. What if Mexico staged an intervention, sent a law enforcement force or a military force into the United States to kidnap the United States citizen to take him or her back to Mexico? And if Mexico said, well, that's just a law enforcement operation. That is not how the law works. If the law worked that way, it would open the door to chaos and violence and disorder on a global scale, because states would be able to just cross each other's borders and conduct all sorts of law enforcement operations. And so international law is clear on this, that what we call jurisdiction to enforce, the ability to, for example, enforce your own law or court order, is purely territorial. We can enforce those within the United States, but we cannot cross the borders of other sovereign countries to enforce our own law or court orders. And so that distinction is really not meaningful from the perspective of international law.
Professor, some are framing this move as an act of self-defense, according to the UN, under the UN Charter, by the U.S. What are your feelings on that assertion?
Yes, the argument there would be that Venezuela has staged an armed attack against the United States because it has, under the leadership of Maduro, engaged in drug operations, drug smuggling into the United States, and that's somehow harming the United States. Under the United Nations Charter, Article 51 of the UN Charter says that if you are under an armed attack or an imminent threat of an armed attack, you can respond by force in self-defense. The problem here for that argument is that these actions, even assuming that Maduro is responsible for some of these drug operations that have perhaps harmed some individuals in the United States, those actions do not rise to the level of an armed attack under international law that would then give rise to this claim of self-defense. Under international law, and there have been multiple International Court of Justice cases on this point, an armed attack has to be of a sufficient scale, gravity, magnitude, and has to actually involve a use of military force. And so whatever Maduro and Venezuela might be doing when it comes to drug smuggling just does not rise to the level of an armed attack that would give rise to this claim of self-defense for the United States.
So, Professor, there's a historical parallel to the 1989 capture of Manuel Noriega when U.S. officials argued that the president could violate customary international law to enforce U.S. criminal statutes. In your view, does that precedent strengthen the U.S. position here, or does it expose a longstanding legal weakness?
Well, so that case, the Noriega case, and that legal precedent that you mentioned is essentially based on an opinion, an Office of Legal Counsel memorandum authored by Bill Barr back in 1989, where he essentially argued that our law enforcement, our FBI, could just cross international borders and enforce all sorts of U.S. court orders left and right abroad. That view is certainly not shared by any other countries. It does not reflect or represent international law. And I would argue that there has been significant pushback against that view. Now, the Noriega situation is important. It does create some kind of a precedent for our courts. But I would also argue that there are some distinctions. So one important distinction is that Noriega himself was not actually the president of Panama. He held like a different title and ruled the country through puppet presidents, but he wasn't the official president of Panama. And that argument becomes relevant for the purposes of this head of state immunity argument that Maduro's lawyers are certainly going to advance in court here in the United States. In addition, the General Assembly of Panama at the time had declared war against the United States. Now, whether they were actually going to act upon it or not remains questionable, but they had actually passed a resolution declaring war against the United States. Under those circumstances, the claim of self-defense by the United States against Panama actually has some credibility, has some teeth, because there you can say they're about to stage a war against us. We're now acting in self-defense. Venezuela has never declared war against the United States, and so that situation is different. And then last but not least, when it comes to Noriega, his own government had actually waived his own immunity, his sovereignty, and said essentially to the United States, it's okay, you can go ahead and prosecute him, we don't mind. In the case of Venezuela, Vice President Delcy Rodriguez, the day after the attacks by the United States, said Maduro is still a legitimate president. And so in light of that, I would distinguish the Noriega situation a little bit, but there are many in the international community who would say that the U.S. actions against Panama in 1989 were equally illegal under international law, that that also should not have happened. And so there are some small distinctions. I think there are distinctions that are valid and important for the purposes of U.S. law. But I think under international law, you could claim that both of these were actually illegal and in violation of the United Nations Charter and corresponding customary law.
Professor, so you mentioned armed attack and you know, if the U.S. could act this way in seizing Maduro, bring him to the U.S., or in attacking the, you know, alleged drug boats in the water, if they could act that way, if it was, you know, an act of self-defense to armed attack, what is the definition of armed attack? Because I think, you know, the pushback would be, what about cyber attacks? I mean, that's not a traditional armed attack, but that would certainly be something that you can invoke self-defense tactics for, or economic attacks. Or, you know, I think that is the argument in favor of doing this, is that, you know, many more millions, according to Trump, if you believe his stats, have been killed by this than, you know, any traditional armed attack. If Venezuela, you know, launched an attack on U.S. soil and maybe they killed 100 people, the argument is that this act of drug trafficking over years and years has, you know, resulted in so many more deaths. Why does that not fit the definition of armed attack?
Yeah, so The International Court of Justice has ruled in a series of cases, starting with the Nicaragua versus the United States case back in 1985, that an action, in order for an action to constitute an armed attack under international law, it has to be of a significant scale, gravity, and magnitude. It has to involve essentially a more protracted use of force by one country against another or a non-state actor against another. So these actions that are, for example, like cyber attacks or drug smuggling simply do not rise to that level of gravity, scale, and magnitude in order to give rise to an armed attack, which then gives rise to this claim of use of force in self-defense. And if you think about it a little bit, I think it makes sense because the main purpose of international law, as it has developed since after World War II, is to prohibit and minimize the use of force. And so we don't want countries to be able to say, well, so-and-so staged a cyber attack, and as a result, we're going to be using our nuclear weapons to destroy their capital, right? We don't want those types of situations to arise. And so as a result, we require a significant use of force in order for there to be an armed attack, which then gives rise to this claim of self-defense. And so again, international law since World War II, which developed based on overwhelming consensus by states, including the great powers like the United States, USSR, China, and others, is to say, let's agree that we're just not going to use force, or that we're not going to use force that much. Now, it's not to say that force has never been used since the end of World War II. That would have been a great situation to be able to say, well, yes, the charter has worked beautifully. No states have ever used force. But when states use force in the international arena, they oftentimes attempt to justify their actions. They attempt to say it's self-defense, or they try to say, we tried to involve the Security Council. They say our interests were harmed, which tells you that they're trying to abide by these international legal norms. A big problem in international law is that international law does not have any direct enforcement mechanisms. So when great powers like the United States violate international law, a lot of the time nothing really happens to them. But I do think that these international law norms are relevant because they do constrain the actions of states to some extent and at least force states to try to justify what they're doing within the language of international law.
I think you touched on our last question. You know, no matter what we discuss and no matter how violative of international law this is the reality on the ground that U.S. courts will allow this to proceed. I think just yesterday, over the weekend, at least Saturday or Sunday, I saw a stat that, something like 75% or 80% of federal court judges have followed the Trump administration, right? And Trump himself said there's no such thing as international law. He said on the plane, the only constraint on, you know, my power is my own morality. Screw international law. So what does this really mean practically?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. So if I had to predict, I do think that the prosecution of Maduro and his wife will actually proceed in the Southern District of New York, even though the act of kidnapping and abduction of Maduro and his wife were a blatant violation of international law. So let me unpack that just a little bit. So it is absolutely true that our federal judges tend to be super deferential to the executive branch, especially in these cases implicating foreign relations and executive power. So as a general starting point, I would say the courts just tend to defer to the DOJ, tend to defer to the executive branch. But in addition, we have case law here in the United States coming from our Supreme Court, the Kerr and the Frisbee cases from the 1800s, and then the Alvarez-McCain case from 1992, which stand for the proposition that even if a defendant is kidnapped, abducted, forcefully brought to the United States, that does not per se divest our federal courts of jurisdiction. The prosecution can still proceed. And so we have both specific precedent on this issue, but then we also have this general judicial deference to the executive branch, meaning that I would predict that the case in the Southern District would proceed. Maduro's attorneys are definitely going to raise those arguments. They're also going to claim that he has head of state immunity. But I think that at least as an initial matter, the case will not be dismissed at the preliminary stages. I think it will proceed to the merits.
Professor Molinasterio, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
It's a pleasure. Glad to be here.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini. I'm Ryan Burrow. Well, the new year really doesn't begin until Amanda comes on to Legal Face-Off to discuss new laws of the year in Illinois, none of which helped move the Bears to Arlington Heights, by the way. Amanda Vinicki is Vice President Communications at the Illinois Economic Development Corporation. Amanda, so great to see you again in 2026.
Great to see you. Happy New Year. It is midway through the month, and I still have yet to make any resolutions. So if anybody has tips, I'm here for it.
Resolution is no more Happy New Year's after today.
Okay.
I put a moratorium on
I'm down with that. At some point, it has to stop.
Amanda, we've been doing this podcast for 11 years. I feel like you've been doing this segment, as Ryan mentioned, at least nine, if not more. So we really appreciate you coming back on and covering important and some, you know, lesser important new laws in Illinois. Let's talk. We grabbed seven that we thought were interesting. Let's dive right into the Safe Schools for All Act. What's happening with that one?
Okay, so everybody who lives in or near Chicago is certainly aware of Operation Midway Blitz and the impact that it had on families, including that there were some parents who didn't let their children attend school, or then there were some volunteer organizations that organized sort of student parades so that children who were not able to attend class or couldn't get to school otherwise because their parents weren't going to leave their homes for fear of getting apprehended, that they did that. This is sort of a measure that aims to get those kids in school, that has schools be the safe place for which Illinois law had previously intended, but it makes it more explicit that every child, regardless of immigration status, has a right to an education from kindergarten through 12th grade. And so that is what this does. There is also a requirement that school districts have in place protocols and operations that they send to the state that are really on the books, so everybody knows those rules. There's school districts have some 6 months to get that in place. But the fact that schools are really a safe zone, that you cannot ask families or students their immigration status in order to be enrolled, that you cannot make threats against somebody to say, we are going to report you as a result of their attending school or doing something in school, that is all part of the protections that are covered in this new law. I'll add that it is one of several that Illinois took in the face of some of the aggressive tactics taken by the federal government when it comes to immigration.
Amanda, tell us about the squatter trespass enforcement law that just got passed.
You know, this is an interesting one because I remember, particularly during the height of the COVID pandemic, Illinois took a lot of action to protect people who might not be able to afford their rent or, you know, pay their mortgage, that in the midst of a pandemic, that they weren't suddenly homeless. There were criticisms then by realtors that they said Illinois has gone too far. What happened here was an Illinois state representative, Marcus Evans, said that he kind of experienced what the realtors had been having qualms about himself when a neighbor had squatters living in their home and they wouldn't leave. Police came and said, we can't do anything about it. And that is because there's very intentionally a lot of protections that make it difficult to evict somebody. You need to go to court. You need to prove measures that have been taken. That is, again, intended for people who are on a lease, supposed to be living someplace. Squatters are not that. They are just that. They're frankly trespassing according now to this new law. So you no longer need to go to court. It gives police more enforcement authority. Should somebody say you maybe have moved to another home and are trying to sell one, and so it's empty. Or maybe you that sort of situation. You're saying, no, you don't get to just pop in and claim that this is your home and that you have legal protections.
You know, Amanda, Ryan and I were talking before we started about Saturday, this past Saturday, being a monumental day in the history of Chicago sports. Bears won a historic playoff game. The Bulls won. They beat Cooper Flag and the Mavericks. Blackhawks won on the road, where there was a lot of fans chanting Green Bay sucks. And the Cubs, our beloved Cubs, signed Sean Bregman, right? The Cubs, of course, The Cubs end every game with "Go Cubs, go!" After every win. It was written by a guy named Steve Goodman. This is all a long build up to this story about the towing companies, because Steve Goodman also wrote a song called "Linkin Park Pirates" in 1972 that starts with these lyrics: "In Chicago, where I live, there's an outfit that would tow anything, almost anything off the street. They deal mostly with automobile, and we call them the Linkin Park Pirates." Why is that song relevant to this new law that we're talking about?
I was wondering where you were going with it.
It was a long build
up. I appreciated it. It was great. And you know what? Let me try to further extend this and say that some of this, like the lengths at which you needed to go to make that transition are how some people feel when their car is towed by a bad actor. There we go. How's that for transition? So this law aims to give more protections to individuals who might be preyed upon by a tow company. I'm not going to name any particular names there. And part of one of the things evidently that these bad actors do is actually they change their names. So you might rack up a lot of fines with the Illinois Commerce Commission, which has long had the ability to penalize companies, but they don't care. They say, all right, we're going to change our name. Now we don't have to pay those fines, move on, start a different towing company, again, in name only, and then prey on maybe accident victims. They might involve practices like trying to put a lien on if you have medical equipment or a car seat. And let me tell you, as somebody with a toddler, we are talking hundreds of dollars sometimes for a car seat. They are not inexpensive. And putting a lien so that they would say, no, you can't get your car back. You've got to pay us for this property first. All of that is now not necessarily all of that is now going to be in the power of the ICC to crack down on companies. Those practices are not tolerated. They are not allowed. Their licenses for towing could be revoked and then prohibited from operating any additional towing business for a couple of years if they are caught engaging in that sort of really, let's be honest, jerky behavior. It stinks to get your car towed, period, let alone by somebody or a company and an entity that is not following the rules and making a crummy situation a heck of a lot worse.
And this next law is kind of out of left field, but it involves toiletries in hotels, at least certain hotels. Tell us more about this one.
So, you know, this is actually, it had sort of a long lead up. Again, I think the General Assembly passed it in 2024, but taking effect because you wanted to give hotels time to figure everything out. I don't know about any of you, but I at least have some of those like baby bottles of lotion. I carry them in my purse. I have them on my desk at work. They're handy, but they're also pretty terrible for the environment. They use a heck of a lot of plastic. But what can I say? If you're traveling particularly, you can't fly with a lot of liquids. I don't always pack my own lotion. So here we go. Illinois has now said that instead of those single-use disposables for toiletries, instead hotels need to have dispensers that you would use sort of like when you just, you know, wash your hands in a public restroom, that sort of thing for shampoo, for body wash, all of that. And really, this is meant to be an environmental practice. I know I've been to hotels that have this already and everything works out just great. I'm just going to have to buy my own lotion to keep in my desk.
Good luck finding a bar of soap at any hotel these days. It's literally impossible. We got a couple more to go here. Cocktails to go. Thank God the legislature has finally tackled this massive problem in society that now in Illinois, you could take your booze to go.
Liquor law is so complicated, more than anybody would think. I've got kind of bad news. I've seen this law described a lot as permanent cocktails to go. And no, the legislature would not make anything that easy. In fact, it's through like summer of 2028, and then they're going to have to take yet another look at it. I will make an early prediction that it will be extended, but this is the sort of thing that the legislature does. They don't give you a total free rein. They're like, nope, come back. We've got to check it out. But at least for a while, we can be sure that cocktails to go will continue. One of the legacies of the pandemic that lives on. And I have to say, frankly, cheers to that. I took great advantage of it. There's a place I live in Wicker Park, and there's a place called Dorian's Through the Record Shop, and it had amazing cocktails, and they would pair them with some vinyl because they're also a record shop, right? It was really cool. So I think they stopped doing that, but they could, thanks to this law. And by the way, this law does some other changes that are meant to make things easier from some distillers and some greater protection. So for example, if you do get cocktails delivered to your home, you've got to sign off. It's saying I'm 21 or over.
So Amanda, walk us through real quick the last two we've got on tap here. We now have an official state bean. And there's also now a long-term care law for canines.
Let me focus on the soybean one, because I think that is interesting, because Illinois, of course, is huge in ag. We are sometimes number one, sometimes number two when it comes to corn, same with soy, but really number one for soy. Corn has gotten a lot of the attention. We have. Corn is the official state grain. Sweet corn is the official state vegetable, and then popcorn is the official snack food of the state of Illinois. So soy has really been left out. And so now, yes, Illinois will have an official state bean. You constantly wonder how many more, you know, state designations can be added to the list, but we already have a proposal that would add an official state soda. I don't know if anybody here has tried Ski. It's sort of like a Sprite or a 7-Up sort of thing, but sweeter still. So Ski could become the next proposal that we are talking about should it become a law in 2027. I don't know. Maybe they'll have to serve it at Bears games as part of whatever agreement Illinois may or may not come to keep the Bears in the state of Illinois versus Indiana.
I'm surprised it's not Green River, to be honest with you.
There you go. You know, there's still a chance. We could definitely have. There was once a pair of legislators debating who was going to be like the official state polka band. And I believe nobody, I've got to look it up, but as memory serves, that sort of just ended in a stalemate because the legislators couldn't agree on which of the polka bands is, it's such a big regional thing. So you might have some Green River fans going toe to toe with the Ski ones.
There you go. Did we get through all of them? Are we good? Is that it? Is that all we've got?
Whoops. You know, can I just say real quick, because I think there's like 281 bills that took effect or laws that took effect January 1 of 2026. So we got through a couple of them, but that's a heck of a lot of changes. So there are some pretty significant ones as well when it comes to like gun storage and some repercussions there. And then as I alluded to, wanted to mention that there are some additional protections for immigrants and also some AI protections that Illinois has in place. And those are interesting to follow just because of the President Trump's executive order that says that it sort of seems to hint that those are too cumbersome in his view. And so it could yet again put Illinois in the crosshairs of the federal government when it comes to Illinois wanting to get out in front of artificial intelligence regulation.
And Amanda, I'm hearing some rumblings in Springfield about trying to tackle Safety Act perhaps a little bit here in 2026 and fine tuning that. But hopefully we can talk to you before 2027. What do you think?
I would love that. It is always a pleasure.
It was great having you on.
Thanks, guys.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to Legal Faceoff at WGNradio.com. Big Law's new recruiting style is forcing first-year law students to make decisions they're not ready for. At least that's the opinion of our guest, Anna DeSalvo Konchak. She's director of the Office of Career Services at Temple University Beasley School of Law. Thanks so much for coming on with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So Anna, as Ryan mentioned, and for those of us who have been involved with Big Law Summer Associate Recruiting, for many years. When you look at what's been happening over the past several years, we've seen a gradual acceleration of the timeline and timing within which law firms are recruiting law students, culminating in the most recent hiring cycle where recruiting began before many 1Ls even took their first set of finals. How did we get here?
So that's a really good question. So after NALP, the National Association for Law Placement, removed the specific mention of recruiting timelines in their recruitment guidelines in 2018, and then the pandemic came in, of course, and caused both more direct firm-to-student engagement as well as virtual OCI programs, which previously had been in-person hosted on campus by offices like mine. Since then, we've seen the recruiting timelines for big law firms move steadily earlier and earlier, creeping up every year. And the really big recent shift that we've seen is that firms are really no longer waiting for those 1L spring grades before starting the recruiting process for 2L summer associate positions. So this year, we're seeing many firms recruiting for 2L summer associates often at the same time that they're recruiting for 1L positions, sometimes as early as October or November of 1L year, at a time when students have barely started their first semester of law school.
So why do you think, why do you think this is happening? I know that, you know, COVID was part of it in terms of the shift away from in-person interviewing to virtual, but we're now in a post-COVID world, right? Where, you know, return to office started a long time ago. So we're as back to normal as we've ever been since pre-COVID. Can you point to anything in particular that caused this huge acceleration of the timeline, particularly within the last cycle?
Yeah, well, so those NALP guidelines never went back to mentioning a specific date. And even though we are post-COVID, people are back in office, you know, we're back on campus, OCI programs largely have stayed virtual, which in some ways, you know, I think that can be helpful to students and to firms. It's less of a huge cost to firms. Students are able to maybe participate in more interviews and maybe even expand the geographic reach of their applications. That's another, you know, maybe silver lining of having more direct firm to student interactions, right? Students aren't just limited to the firms that are recruiting through their law school. But I think keeping those OCI programs virtual and the steady continuation and increase of direct firm to student engagement has really driven, you know, firms seeing maybe one of their competitors going a little bit earlier. So the next year they move earlier, and even, you know, mid recruiting cycle, sometimes firms will shift gears in order to stay competitive, which, you know, I understand that positioning for sure.
And I know you talked about jumbo bonuses and loyalty bonuses. That seems to be part of the bigger picture. This whole topic seems to be part of the bigger picture that the market shifted, right? And it's very much a seller's market, the seller being the candidates, right? We're seeing that at our level. It's very hard to find attorneys who are qualified, who are willing to do certain types of law. The bonuses at the year end for big law were record numbers, right? I mean, every firm that released their bonus numbers or that were released seemed to be like, you know, top the next one. So what does this say, in your opinion, about the bigger legal market out there? I mean, it's good news, bad news for law firms, a little bit of good news for candidates, right?
Yeah, I mean, I really think, you know, based on my experience working directly with law students, this accelerated timeline, I really don't think is good for anyone involved, particularly for law students, because they're really being deprived of the opportunity to meaningfully explore different areas of law and really dive into the law school experience before turning to all of these career questions and career decisions and making some really important, sometimes career making or unfortunately breaking decisions very early on in their law school career. So first year students are sort of frantically trying to figure out which firm or practice area, you know, might be the best fit for them. And of course, how to present themselves as a strong candidate when they haven't even finished, you know, foundational first year courses or had an internship or taken an elective. And so I think that trying to strike that balance of learning how to outline while rushing to build, you know, networking contacts and prepare application materials has just caused stress and anxiety to be at an all-time high among law students.
So Anna, talk to us for a second about the impact that this acceleration has had on law schools such as yours and folks that are part of the community that help support students. What has this phenomenon forced law schools to do?
Yeah, so it hasn't been easy for law schools either. You know, as a student-facing office, you know, my first concern and the thing most important to me is always going to be the student experience, but it's certainly challenging for law schools and, you know, staff and faculty as well. It's really disruptive to the first-year process. I think faculty are seeing students who are just more stressed out and frankly distracted by the recruiting pressures and the noise of all of the things they should be thinking about above and beyond their classes and their coursework. Students are often rushing through things like their legal research and writing courses just to try to churn out, you know, hopefully a usable writing sample, you know, and work on their application materials. And even seeing less of an incentive to get involved with experiences like law review or moot court or other extracurriculars, which used to be so important to building a law student's resume. But because now those things are taking place often after the recruiting cycle is completed, they're not being given, you know, as much value, which is a real shame because they're still incredibly valuable and important experiences. And career offices like mine, of course, we're sprinting to, you know, sort of cram in all of our professional development and workshops and other programs and networking into an already packed semester and trying to work with students who are really already maxed out on their bandwidth.
Then explain, you know, because the easy, explain a little more, because I think the easy pushback to what you're saying is that what's wrong with law students, you know, ultimately getting what they want, what most of them want out of law school earlier, a job, right? And perhaps a lucrative job given the market. You know, why is that not good to get them started on that and get them, you know, thinking about and actually, you know, working towards that ultimate goal, which is, you know, for most law students, some of them want to go maybe into public interest law or some other area, but for most interest, you know, most of them, they have student loans to pay off. Why isn't that process better to start as early as possible? What are they losing in this process?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good question, because that is true. You know, when you think about why isn't it better just to achieve that goal? I think for some students, some do come in knowing that's what they want. But I think particularly for students who come from first generation families or, you know, from groups that traditionally don't have the access to the information that students who come from, you know, long lines of lawyers have, they may not be as familiar with the process or as aware. They may need a little more time to sort of get their feet under them and figure out, you know, not only, you know, what is my goal? Do I want to go into public interest? Do I want to go into private practice? What is this sector of the legal market, you know, called big law? And how do I make sense of that? But I think there's a little bit of a myth out there in the big law space that all big firms are the same. They're really not, right? They vary so widely in terms of practice area focus, culture, priorities, all sorts of things. And I think it really takes time to understand all of those differences and for students to evaluate how those differences align with what they're interested in long term. So I think the downside can be either missed opportunities, someone who would have been interested, but maybe wasn't quite decided and didn't go through the process or engage in the process meaningfully enough to get a summer associate position early on. But also mismatched pairings, right, between students and firms that end up not being the right fit.
So, Anna, pulling this all together, do you think this model as it is sustainable?
You know, I don't think that it is. I think the early timelines, you know, with all of the students that I've worked with all of the recruiters and professional development folks from firms that I've talked to, I haven't heard anyone who likes it, right? No one seems to be happy with it. It's super challenging for firms as well. They're not winning here either. They're trying to make really big decisions and really big investments in their junior attorneys with a dearth of information about candidates, right? It's very hard to evaluate candidates when they're just coming to law school. They don't have grades yet. They haven't gone through, you know, any of the things we talked about earlier, like law review, things like that. So I think it really undermines both the intellectual endeavors of 1L year and also makes it more difficult for firms. And I think ultimately, you know, we haven't seen the data of how that's going to work out in the end. But I think the likelihood of increased reneging, increased attrition, you know, and mismatch both practice group and firm-wise, I think makes this system just unsustainable and where nobody wins.
Anna, we can't, I think, discuss this topic without discussing the impact of AI. AI. And in fact, a survey from Citigroup and Hildebrand Consulting, you know, talks about how the need for newer attorneys will continue to decrease as AI gradually replaces younger attorneys. So how is that affecting, you know, this whole issue? And also, how is it affecting, you mentioned, you know, first year scrambling to get all this done? I mean, they have to be using AI also to fill in the gaps in some respects.
Yeah, so we haven't seen, the data hasn't quite given us a clear picture yet of exactly how AI will impact the hiring landscape yet. I think it's been entry-level hiring has stayed where it, you know, where it was consistently, but I do think it's definitely something that students are aware of, and it's on all of our minds thinking about how it could change the demand for entry-level attorneys. And certainly the impact that it will have on what skills entry-level attorneys will be expected to have. And so I think that's another concern for students thinking, you know, not only do I need to get through my foundational courses, but what are the, you know, AI skills that I'm expected to have, and where and how am I going to build those to be a marketable entry-level candidate?
We're going to have to leave it there. Anna DeSalvo-Konchak with Temple University's Beasley School of Law. Thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Thanks so much for having me.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, the greatest team in football history, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN, and it's time for the Legal Grab Bag. Matt LaFave is a civil litigator with LaFave Bagley. Is it Beagley or Bagley?
Bagley.
Bagley, nailed it. All right, in Columbia, South Carolina, he focuses a majority of his practice in insurance defense, corporate defense, premises liability, automobile insurance, coverage disputes, contract disputes, workers' compensation defense. We're almost there. Products liability. Matt, thanks so much for coming on with us.
Thank you.
Polly James is Senior Director of Risk Management for Feld Entertainment in beautiful Tampa, Florida. She's worked at Hilton. She's worked at General Motors. We've got her here on LFO. Polly, thanks for jumping on with us.
Glad to be here.
All right. So we talked with one of our guests about how the UN is looking into the capture of Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro. But was it a legal maneuver according to U.S. law? Rich, you brought this up for us.
Well, the DOJ, not surprisingly, Tina, has indicated at least to lawmakers on Capitol Hill that they found a legal justification to capture Maduro and his wife. We don't quite know the details of it yet, but at the end of the day, we kind of know what, you know, what it'll be, which is that this was, as we talked earlier with the professor about, this was a criminal action. This was an arrest of someone that had already been investigated by the prior administration. So this was not an act of war. This was not kidnapping. This was not, you know, illegal under any international law. And even if it was, Trump doesn't care. He said unequivocally that there is no such thing as international law. And, you know, the ultimate decision maker is him. I mean, these are all things that we know from Trump. He doesn't care. So at the end of the day, you know, as we also heard from the professor, courts at the federal, judges at the federal level give great deference to the DOJ, especially this DOJ and these federal judges, many of whom were put in place by Trump under the first administration. So, you know, he'll get his day in court. I don't think preventing him from getting heard is going to work. And certainly, you know, if the Dems win in November, there might be some congressional action against this. But I think at least criminally, the case will proceed.
Agree, Rich. And that seems to align with what our guest said. That being said, just because it may be legal under U.S. law, you know, we're talking about somebody who's not in the U.S., who is the president of a country that is not the U.S. And so, I mean, this aligns with a lot of the conversation we've had in prior shows about Trump. I mean, this is more of the same.
Polly, what do you think? I mean, do you think most people care about the minutiae of whether, I mean, it's not minutiae, it's important stuff, but do you think the layperson, you know, worries about whether Trump violated the law, or do you think this was a bad guy? We got him out of a country that's, you know, has lots of, you know, valuable resources as an important, and is important in the Western Hemisphere, and, you know, that's fine.
So I think most people don't think it's fine, at least the people I've been talking to. You know, Trump is kind of trampling over the Congress and has justified that with, oh, well, they're very leaky and I don't want that kind of stuff getting out. It would have jeopardized the mission, right? But I think people are seeing through to, hey, is this really oil interests? And, you know, suddenly is it just coincidental that suddenly gas prices are going down and the California refineries are shutting down, right? So is this concurrent timing, is it incidental or is it somehow related?
Right. I mean, I think it's a good point. And Matt, you know, I think the logical question that many are asking is like, where does it end? If the U.S. decides unilaterally, at least this administration, that there are bad actors in one country, where does it end? He's already indicated, you know, that he might take action in Colombia, in Mexico. I mean, Mexico is one of the biggest trading partners of the U.S. They're a massive country right next to us. You know, where does it end? So that's certainly a slippery slope.
Certainly. And I was reading recently that there's been discussion about Iran and other places like that. I think the concern is that you're couching this as an arrest when you're utilizing military force to enact the arrest. And a sovereign entity, I think, and Polly made a great point about the timing of it. And, you know, there's the seizure of the oil tanker that happened shortly thereafter. I don't think that's simply something that happened by accident. I think the timing of it all sort of signals what the true motive was behind the arrest.
And remember, this is from a president who ran on the idea of no stupid wars, no foreign wars, America first. And also, you know, how do we have the ability to criticize and act upon a country like Russia going in and taking over the Ukraine when that's exactly what the U.S. is doing and now threatening to do in places like Greenland, right? I mean, you know, Trump just said a few days ago that if Denmark doesn't agree to, you know, U.S. stepping in and on Greenland, then they'll just do it by force. I mean, how is that different from what Putin has done for years, right? So it doesn't give us a lot of standing to act against other countries doing this when we're doing the same thing.
All right, let's go on to Minneapolis and that ICE agent who shot and killed the demonstrator. We all know the story at this point. What we don't know is if anything will happen to that agent. Tina, you threw this in the bag for us.
And so last week, as you mentioned, there was an encounter between ICE officers and a woman named Renee Nicole Good, who is an American citizen. Unfortunately, that incident ended in gunfire with an ICE officer killing her in the middle of the street. Trump went to social media pretty quickly after and said that the shooting of Good was as a result of her violently, willfully, and viciously running over the ICE officer with her car. The Homeland Security Secretary, Kristi Noem, accused her of trying to run the officer over, saying she hit him in an act of domestic terrorism. And the agency called her a violent rioter. And this has been termed an act of self-defense. But the Minneapolis mayor, Jacob Frey, sharply rejects this version. A lot of us have seen the video of the incident. And Frey said that the federal officials were trying to spin this as an act of self-defense. Obviously, this is against the backdrop of George Floyd and a bunch of issues involving ICE and what many people who are protesting this claim is the expanded role of federal immigration enforcement particularly in certain democratic cities like Minneapolis. There were protests against ICE held across the country this past weekend, with hundreds demanding ICE agents to leave their city. In addition to a Minneapolis protest, there were protests in other major cities, including in Chicago, Rich.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think probably parties on both sides would admit that they acted too quickly. And now it seems the consensus is that we should wait until the investigation is concluded before we make judgment. I think that's true. I think, again, both sides, you know, looking at this video would admit that now. But, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, we're a legal show and we want to look at this legally. I mean, legally, I don't think there's any question. I don't think there's much debate whether this officer will be charged with a crime. He won't be. The standard that's been set forth by the Supreme Court and upheld, you know, in many courts below that is not what we as the public or what even the officer would do after, you know, minutes, hours, days, months of reflection and hindsight and looking at many, you know, videos. I mean, the standard as to whether he committed a crime is whether in the heat of that, in those seconds, whether he acted reasonably. There's no immunity, despite what, you know, the vice president said. The vice president's a lawyer. He doesn't know what he's talking about with regards to immunity. He said there's unqualified immunity. That's not true. Police officers don't have blanket immunity to do anything they want. But the standard is what a reasonable officer would do in that split second, understanding that it's very difficult to make a decision in a split second. And courts have bent over backwards. And the Supreme Court has said, you know, it's a difficult job. And what I don't think there's any question that he won't be charged. Now, whether it was right, whether it was moral, whether all those are you know, perfectly good questions. But, you know, I think any court, any district attorney would rule that what he did complies with the Supreme Court standard and he won't be charged. Matt, what do you think?
So I would actually take it a step back, and this is something that hits close to home for me and my law firm. We have, and I currently represent one of our local sheriffs in a lot of his cases. And our firm has historically handled, you know, false arrests and excessive force type cases. You know, this is something for me that goes all the way back before the shooting even happened to what's the probable cause for initiating the stop to begin with. And, you know, I struggle with the notion that you've got ICE agents who are what seems to be attempting to conduct a traffic stop of a U.S. citizen. So I'd be curious as to what the probable cause was to initiate the stop. So you take that then a step further, and you hit the nail on the head, Rich, which is it's the agents are going to be questioned and looked at as to how they handled this based on that particular situation as it unfolded, not, as you've noted, what we look at in hindsight, Monday morning quarterbacking this thing to say, should he have shot to kill, or should he have even pulled his weapon or simply stepped aside to avoid being hit? So I think there's a whole lot to it. And I think you're probably right, though. I think the clamor of the people may lead to some charges. Now, charges obviously don't mean you're going to get, you know, a conviction. So,
Holly, what are your thoughts?
So, well, I looked into the shooter, Ross. And while the article that you shared was talking a lot about how there have been questionable training and recruiting tactics with ICE, this guy was experienced. He was an experienced officer, and he had been with the military, the Indiana National Guard. He was also with U.S. Border Patrol from 2007 to 2015, and he's been with ICE since 2015. So he has a lot of experience in dealing with these things. But then this same officer was dragged by another vehicle just in June of 2025. So he was attempting to arrest a target of ICE. He broke a back window. They had the car stopped. He broke a back window, and he was reaching in to try and unlock the door, and the car took off and dragged him. And he ended up with about 50 stitches. So, you know, whether he should even have been assigned to be managing traffic stops with ICE with that sort of PTSD fairly recent is a question I would ask.
Yeah, but does that matter? I mean, that's background, and that probably, in my opinion, gives further explanation of why he did what he did. But does that make him more likely to be charged with murder? The fact that maybe he was, you know, trigger happy. Maybe he was more inclined to shoot than someone who wasn't dragged. I don't know, but I don't think that he, as much as perhaps you would want him, like, I'm not saying that he shouldn't be charged or I don't want there to be some justice for this victim, but I just think from a pure objective legal perspective, knowing the Supreme Court standard, I would be shocked if he was charged.
Right. I don't think it'll be, I think his personal immunity is pretty strong. I mean, the Supreme Court has given a lot of protections and said that they're going to very narrowly interpret that, but maybe they have a case against the government for putting him back in that situation, right? And maybe under FECA.
Another quick question I want to point out, maybe one of the lawyers can add to this. Does the fact that the FBI is the only investigating body in this case now, and they basically said no to local, can local prosecutors still prosecute in this case if the FBI is handling the investigation?
No, I mean, he's a federal agent, so federal jurisdiction is the only, you know, jurisdiction that applies. But and that's a whole, you know, political thing that the feds are saying that Minneapolis local police can't be trusted. I mean, that's just a Trump, you know, game. But
so
yeah,
any prosecution would have to come from the DOJ then?
Correct.
Okay. Gotcha. All right. Well, ahead of his big Super Bowl halftime appearance, Puerto Rican performer Bad Bunny is being sued for allegedly using a woman's voice on a couple tracks. You'd actually think this is a Tina story, but Rich, you were the one who threw this into the grab bag.
Well, we're going to tee it up for Tina because this is her expertise. But yeah, the lawsuit alleges that Bad Bunny, anyone know his real name? I didn't know that till I looked at the story. Benito Antonio Martinez Ocasio is being sued in Puerto Rico in his native land and his label for $16 million, brand new lawsuit. And this woman, the plaintiff, says that a recording of her voice saying the words Mira Puneta, no me, I won't even do it justice because I will butcher it. But this one sentence was used without her permission on not one, but two songs, Tina by Bad Bunny, from 2018 and 2025. She said that the request or the recording was initially made by the producer when they were classmates and there was no contract or license. And that now her voice was not just used for this recording, but in many promotions, concerts. And obviously now Bad Bunny is literally the biggest star on earth in terms of music industry. He'll be playing in the Super Bowl here in a few weeks, I should say. So, you know, I don't know what Puerto Rico piracy or, you know, right of publicity law and privacy rights. I assume they're, you know, pretty similar to U.S. since it's a territory. But basically she's saying that anyway, we didn't have a contract back then. So now enforce the contract, right? When the money is good.
Yeah, Rich. I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, obviously these cases turn on the facts, and we've covered Bad Bunny before because you'll remember, I think it was in the last couple of years that his ex-girlfriend accused him of a very similar situation of recording her voice and then, you know, including it in his recordings without her permission. I mean, assuming that the facts are as we were all teed up for this discussion, assuming that they are what they purport to be, you can't use somebody else's likeness or their voice without their permission, particularly for commercial use. Sometimes there is something known as fair use that is that will get you out of what is a straight up copyright infringement. But absent what are some very, very specific and tough exceptions to fall under, you need somebody's permission. I mean, there's issues of right of publicity. There's issues of their moral rights. You recorded their voice. You dubbed it in. You didn't get their permission. You know, as we talked about with his ex-girlfriend and the same type of facts and fact pattern, it's something you just can't do unless, you know, without having an agreement, without getting permission. And more often than not, there's royalty involved.
Paula, you deal with a ton of valuable IP every day. What do you think of this lawsuit?
So I think if it's her voice, I mean, we don't even know that for a fact, right? If it is her voice that they're using, then I think she's owed something, whether it's the $16 million that she's demanding or not, could be questionable. I mean, whatever an artist of her caliber might get for, you know, actually including this minor phrase in the song is probably what she should be owed. But I don't even know if it's her voice. I mean, it claimed that it's being used in live concerts. So are they like filling that in the background, or do they just have a backup singer singing that phrase? Right. I don't know.
I guess we'll all have to see on February 8th the Super Bowl if we hear that voice pop up, huh? All right. If you've bought a McRib sandwich, hang on to those receipts. McDonald's is being sued over what's actually in those sandwiches. Rich, you like the McRib sandwich? Is that a go-to for you?
You know, I McDonald's is a client of mine. They have been for years, so I will say only good things about the McRib and every other Mc product out there. But the allegation, as we've seen in lots of food allegations, these are happening almost, you know, every show. We could cover one of these every time. And the allegations is always, Tina, that, you know, the ad is not quite what the product is, that they're selling. They're, you know, defrauding the public by selling them something that's not quite on the up and up, be it a, you know, 10-inch sandwich instead of a 12-inch sandwich, or, you know, instead of a full bag of chips, a half bag. This one is saying that instead of rib, it's actually a bunch of other products from a pig that you would not probably want to put in, you know, after the Mick. Like, you know, if you called it Mick Scalded Stomach, probably wouldn't sell as much. But that's one of the allegations here, that McDonald's is using lower grade products like Scalded Stomach, tripe, heart, and pork shoulder. So, yeah, McHeart doesn't quite have the tangy barbecue ring to it that the McRib does. McDonald's is saying, no, this is, you know, listen, it's not, everything's not literal. This is basically a rib, that the rib is part of the pig, and get out of here. It's a perfectly delicious sandwich, and, you know, you're distorting the facts.
Yeah, Rich. So, I mean, again, my practice actually sometimes steps into this, whether or not you're making some sort of a claim or deceiving the public through things like branding. I mean, let's take a step back here. This sandwich has been around for 40 years, off and on, maybe not consistently, but it's been around for a long time. Second of all, McDonald's has come right out and denied that, you know, all these bad parts of the pig are in the sandwich. And so my guess is this is not going to trial. This is going to get resolved outside the courtroom well before that.
Matt, they say it's 100% seasoned boneless pork dipped into a tangy barbecue sauce.
I'll confess I haven't tried it. I will also confess that my wife makes fun of it every time they bring it back.
I mean, but you're in the land of real barbecue. It's, you know,
that's exactly right. If you had told me it was made of pork shoulder, maybe I'd try it sooner, but you start throwing in heart and scalded stomach, and I'm second guessing that. No, I agree with what Tina just said, and that it seems to me that this is more of a label that's affixed to the sandwich. I don't know that I've ever seen any particular advertising by McDonald's that it contains this part of the pig being the rib meat. But I agree. I think this is something that, you know, will go away fairly quickly outside of the courtroom. I don't think this is something that a lot of people are hotly contesting, because I'm sure the people that eat it love it.
I mean, you know what the defense is? It's the defense is you're paying $4 for a sandwich. Like, what do you think? This is not like high end dining. Like, just no one who buys a McRib is going in there thinking, oh my God, I can't believe I'm being deceived into what I'm eating.
Heart meat might be healthier than ribs.
Yeah, there you go.
Who knows? I mean,
that's why we're picking Polly for this jury, for this case. It's the right answer.
And keep in mind, if these were really rib sandwiches, you'd have bones in your sandwich. So that would probably not be an ideal situation for McDonald's, would be my guess. So, all right. Free Britney. Britney Spears is going after the IRS over a huge tax bill. Tina, what's going on here?
Ryan, she is challenging the IRS. This broke right before the holidays. The IRS has claimed that there's a tax deficiency claim where she owes over $600,000 in connection with her 2021 filings. We covered back at that time on Legal Face Off that her conservatorship happened to end at that same time. And that was the time when she regained control of her finances from her father. So she's contesting the IRS demand in full, saying that she doesn't owe any more in taxes than what she's already paid, and that she has the documents to prove it. The IRS notice of deficiency alleges that there were reporting errors and they were tacking on penalties that will push the total past $600,000, with some documents saying that it will be near $720,000 by the time it's all over. One of the key focal points of this, Rich, is the entity known as Shiloh Standing Inc., which is a company that her father formed in 2008, soon after the conservatorship began. And apparently there's income flowing through that entity, which may have tripped this whole thing, at least as far as the IRS is concerned. There was income of nearly $1.4 million. In addition, the IRS cut some of her claimed deductions, which will lift her taxable income even further. And against the backdrop of all of this, Rich, is the fact that there's been conversation that her net worth has dipped from $60 million to about $40 million, presumably because she's spending a lot of money on luxury items and legal bills.
Yeah, I mean, I think my argument would be, you know, if I was her attorney, Matt, I would say, like, you don't want to accept the deductions for these health expenses. Ironically, if there's anyone in the world who can prove that she needed these, you know, this treatment, it's her, because she's been so public, either willingly or unwillingly, with her issues. I mean, she's still out there doing videos of, like, dancing with knives. If that's not someone who needs seemingly medical care, I don't know who is. And it would seem like, you know, I would just take the opposite view. It's like, this is the bare minimum. We should be expensing way more treatment than this, as evidenced by my client's condition.
Well, and I don't know how. It's not easy to drum up the receipts for the medical treatment.
All right. Yeah. Better record keeping by Brittany.
Well, she says she has all of the receipts. So if she has them, she may very well be successful in contesting this. But the burden is really on her. Like, essentially, the way that these things go, the IRS is given deference once this type of proceeding is started. She's got the burden of proving that they're wrong.
Take a look at some more celebrities. Tina, you threw this one into the bag for us as well. Kind of a sad story involving the Beckhams. Victoria and David have been informed that they should only contact their 26-year-old son through a lawyer. Tina, it's going to make holiday dinners a little awkward, I would think.
Yeah, Ryan. So this has been cooking now for a while, and we'll get to that in a second. But as recently as earlier today, media outlets were reporting that Brooklyn Beckham, who's the son of Victoria and David Beckham, sent his parents a letter to that essentially told them, don't deal with me except through our lawyers. And he claims it's to protect his mental health. He issued a cease and desist letter. This hit the news a few days ago. This apparently was after his parents shared several social media posts of him, particularly on Instagram. He's been trying to create distance from them. You know, this has been months in the making. Apparently, you know, they're trying to reach out to him through social media. He's saying any attempts at reconciliation should be done in private. This apparently goes back to 2022 when Brooklyn got married. His now wife, Nicola Peltz, apparently people think that this whole feud started because instead of wearing a wedding dress under the Victoria Beckham label, she decided to wear a Valentino instead. There was an awkward wedding day moment where Mark Anthony was performing a song and he invited Victoria to join him on the stage and to do a dance with Brooklyn rather than his new wife. And she apparently left in tears. Brooklyn did not show up to his father's 50th birthday bash either. And so this has been happening for a while, Rich. It's sad when a son has to tell his parents, sorry, but if you want to talk to me, you've got to do it through the lawyers.
Yeah. Just another sign that this kid is too damn rich and his wife His fiance is even richer, right? His fiance is the daughter of.
She's like uber wealthy.
Yeah, like Trian Investments and the Madison Square Garden Company, Cisco, Wendy's. That's her dad. But yeah, the kid's too damn rich. I mean, you shouldn't have the means to say that you should only communicate with your parents through lawyers, right? That's what Thanksgiving is for, yelling at your family. Sad story, but, you know, I don't know. Polly, there's another kid, I guess. There's three other children who said that they were also blocked on social media by Brooklyn.
It sounds like they could all use some family counseling.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I mean, in my opinion, it shouldn't take a legal letter to, you know, stop his parents from posting. They should respect his wishes, right? I mean, ideally, you say, hey, don't post about me.
I mean, I'm giving this whole the new thought, Matt. Like, I don't know, maybe my kids would listen to me more if I actually wrote them a legal letter, like an opinion letter that says, you know, you must get off the damn couch and stop playing video games or else.
Put your phone down. We should try that.
I
could have my wife draft it. But I mentioned this to Polly before we went on air, and I said, you know, is it a scenario where he's simply trying to keep the feud out of the public light by communicating through a lawyer to keep some of that correspondence confidential? But I agree. I think it's too much money. It's too bright a light. So,
would have thought that you'd want to stay away from Victoria and David Beckham. I don't think anyone on this panel would want to stay away from them. I think we'd all be very attracted to them in one form or another. All right, new year, new laws. We talked about this a little bit with Amanda at the earlier part of the show, but we've got some strange new laws across the country this year, Tina.
Ryan, so what's really funny is that one of the laws that we covered with Amanda that came into effect January 1st in Illinois, which was the hotel mini toiletry ban, actually made it to the list of some of the funny and strange laws taking effect across the country. I would love to hear what our panel guests have to say about all of this. I mean, some of these are pretty wacky. One of them that's near and dear to my heart, however, as a pet owner, and particularly cats, is the California cat declawing ban, where veterinarians are no longer allowed to declaw cats unless it's medically necessary, which I am a fan of. My furniture is not, but just knowing how detrimental the declawing process is to cats, I'm a fan of that law and would love to hear Rich and others, which one stuck out to you?
Yeah, I mean, I assume you didn't mean stick out as a pun, but I agree that declawing is horrible and should be banned. You know, there was one that I love in California. You could no longer play a TV ad, a commercial that is louder than the show that you're watching, which I love because who among us hasn't been jolted by suddenly, you know, seeing the MyPillow guy screaming at you at a much higher, but I don't know how they're going to, how's that, I mean, I guess technology is such, Polly, that they could fix that, but how the hell do they know what my volume is in on my couch?
Well, but it's the volume that it's being broadcast at, right? You're not changing the volume.
I'm just a dumb guy. What about the bingo night? Man, thank God that this insanity is, thank God this is ending, that in Indiana, you can't play bingo every damn night of the week.
Well, who's funding the bingo pots? Is it the state?
Well,
in which case, maybe the state's losing money.
Exactly, right? Hey, people are spending all their money at the charity. And it wasn't just bingo, right? It was all charity, all charity gambling, I think. Games of chance and such.
No bingo on consecutive nights.
Yeah.
There's really nothing else to do in Indiana, though. I mean, I don't know what our neighbors are going to do. But, you know, that brings us to our roundtable segment. And let's talk about, besides these funny bans, if you were in charge of the legislature in the world, let's say there was a world legislature, what one thing would you ban starting in 2026? If you had omnipotent power, Ryan, am I giving enough of a setup, enough time to think about this one? If you had unlimited power to ban one thing that drives you absolutely nuts, like this TV volume thing, what would you do? You start.
I would like to instantly arrest the people who keep sending me spam texts three a day. I would like to hunt them down. I would like to find them and put them in a place where no one can get at them.
The Indiana Toll Road text.
That's one of them. I've got right now, people want me to sell them my property that I do not own in a state I do not live in. So I've told them that. They continue to reach out to me.
Matt LaFave, if you could ban one thing for 2026, what would it be?
Can we go back, Rich, to the days where Trump has no access to social media?
You can do whatever you want.
I put that right there at the top of the list.
All right. Back in the golden era. Polly James, what would you ban in 2026 if you could?
So I think I would ban using AI for solicitation. No more robocalling.
There it is.
That's a good one. Tina.
Polly, you think that the people that have been calling me aren't even human, maybe?
It's crazy. You know, I was getting calls for multiple different charities, all stemming from Virginia numbers. And they would sound very much like humans. But if you ask them the same question different ways, they always came back with the same exact answer. And I'm like, yeah, it's pretty good AI. It's well, you know, it really sounded authentic until I started tripping it up that way. So now I just block. But, you know, they always have another number that they call from. So you can block 50 million numbers and they still come with another one.
Well, what you got to do is, I'm sure you've seen this on TikTok, you got to put the two phones against each other and just have the competing AIs go fight with each other. That's awesome. Tina, what would you ban?
Ban bad music, you know, where you hear people singing horrible versions of songs that, I mean, they do it so badly that like the songs sound vaguely familiar because it's so bad. I would ban that.
Yeah, but then when will we ever hear the girl from Ipanema again? Lisa, what would you ban starting 1/1/26, which is a few days ago?
I would ban Christmas lights from getting put up before Thanksgiving. I hate that people have them up forever.
Yeah. Amen.
And they need a date to take them down, too.
Starting earlier than ever.
And now they're not only just Christmas lights, right? They have those ones that you put under the eaves, and they flash and they change colors all year round.
Yeah, now you can have St. Patrick's Day lights and Valentine's Day lights and Bears lights. Yeah.
It's fine as long as it's coordinating through the holiday season, not just have some random colors up there.
Lisa, and they should have icicles on them. You know, that's another clue when you have icicle lights up all year round.
Lisa, are you the reason for the bingo ban in Indiana? I was just wondering that.
I am not. I play bingo twice a year for a charity. That's it.
Does this new law hurt you?
No.
Oh, okay. All right.
Very good. I would ban a lot. I mean, I got a lot on this list, obviously, as, you know, someone who's bothered by so many things. But maybe, you know, when you're sitting in a restaurant, the waiter comes over and he's like, they hit you with, would you like still, sparkling, or tap water? Like, when did sitting at a restaurant have so many options that, you know, degrade into class warfare? I'm like, what's next? Maybe you just point me to the toilet and open the lid and I'll just drink out of the toilet like a dog. Is that okay? How about that? Or how about one more thing I'll ban, speaking of restaurants, is when the waiter comes over and he asks the question, have you ever dined with us before? What does that matter? I've dined before. I've been in a restaurant. How different could this process be from every other restaurant in the world? I'm going to order the food. You're going to bring it out. Can we just cut to that part?
They're data mining you. They want to know what your history is. They also ask for the last four of your social. And, you know,
I got one last
one. What kind
of
water you want, right? What? Like, we've got to know.
So I got one last one. One last one. The waiter comes over and they're carrying the food and they're waiting for you to tell them where on the table the food should go. It's like, dude, this is your table. I don't know. I'm paying for this process. Part of the back and forth here is that I order the food. I pay for it. You figure out on the table where to put it. I don't have like an expert architecture degree to know where this stuff goes. Anyway.
Here's another one. How about all of those sort of non-service places where you go and you tap your credit card and then it asks you if you want to add a tip?
Oh yeah, the tip, the dreaded barista tip. Oh hell yeah, I'm going to vote for that ban for sure.
All right. Well, this will end our session of Rich shaking his fist at waiters across the country. Thanks so much, Polly James and Matt LaFay, for joining us on Legal Faceoff. Also, thanks to Professor Milena Stereo of Cleveland State University, Anna DeSalvo Konchak of Temple University, and Amanda Vanicki of the Illinois Economic Development Corporation. Also, thanks to Ben Anderson, Lisa Stegall, as we kick off a new year of Legal Faceoff. Away we go into 2026. Thanks for joining us.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Faceoff. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget.